Much of America's experimental theater world owes a debt to the Living Theater, the company which was co-founded in the late 40s by the husband and wife team of Julian Beck and Judith Malina. Initially, their goal was to find a relevant, modern language for theater. After several years of performing avant-garde plays, they dispensed with fully scripted plays and created theater works that were a setting for controlled anarchy. The actors were not confined to the stage. They could prowl the audience, take off their clothes, and directly address individuals. And the audience was encouraged to verbally or even physically respond. Beck and Malina hoped their theater would create an atmosphere that encouraged nonviolent revolutionary action. Their goals and their means have always been controversial. Eric Bentley described their work as a kind of brainwashing. Clive Barnes saw it as the beginning of a new theatrical form which caters to man's emotional need for ritual and involvement. Julian Beck recently passed away. My guest Judith Malina has been trying to keep the Living Theater alive, with the help of her new artistic co-director, Hanan Reznikoff. She's currently directing the off-Broadway show Us, and she's looking for a new home for the company. Earlier today, I spoke with Judith Malina from the NPR Bureau in New York. She told me what she and Julian Beck had in mind when they first formed the Living Theater.
What existed at the time was primarily the Broadway theater, and there was very little room there for a theater of ideas, a theater of action, a theater which could change the spectator from a passive observer into a participant and into a person whose life would be somehow affected by what had happened in those few hours. That is to make the theater a real means of communicating ideas that we felt passionately and that we felt need communication in this world.
This meant finding scripts that maybe hadn't been written yet, since most theater scripts are written for conventional theater companies.
It meant certainly also to inspire poets to write for the theater, to inspire thinkers to write for the theater, certainly that. And when those scripts didn't exist, we began to create collective creations or to adapt classical or old forms into new forms, or to create new forms of theatrical activity altogether.
I want to ask you about a piece that the Living Theater became internationally famous for, and I'm thinking of Paradise Now, which was a piece that you toured with in 1968. This, I think, was a very good example of your attempts to break down the barrier between actor and audience.
Yes, we certainly tried in that to take the audience through a series of ceremonies and rituals and actions which would bring us and the audience members ever closer together.
What were your ways of engaging the audience in that play?
First of all, we spoke to them. We urged them to speak. We urged them to move. We embraced them. Sometimes we made love to them. And in the end, we took them out into the streets and faced the police.
When you say you made love to them, how literally do you mean that?
Literally.
Really?
Yes.
No, one of the things that happened in the play is that the actors would walk around the stage saying, "I'm not allowed to travel without a passport."
And then no, we didn't walk around the stage ever doing that.
No?
No. What we did was we approached the spectator and looked them close in the eye and said to one single spectator, one single actor, in a very close relationship, "I'm not allowed to travel without a passport." And then we turned away from them because it was the very beginning. This is just the opening moment of the play. And we turned away from them and we created an alienated situation, a situation in which they would answer us or not answer us, but in which we no longer were in contact with them. And then we spent the rest of the evening getting closer to that particular spectator who became part of our obligation to, as we put it in the stage directions, to try to take that spectator to paradise, to try to make those spectators to whom we spoke and whom we touched and whom we embraced, to try to truly inspire that person to take the trip with us toward the beautiful nonviolent anarchist revolution.
One of the things that...
And that's what we were working for.
One of the things that you'd say to the people in the audience is, "I'm not allowed to take my clothes off," and then a lot of the actors would take their clothes off.
We took our clothes off to the legal limit. Mm-hmm. that is, we wore what would be called a bikini, a small costume covering those parts of the body that's illegal to show. The spectators very often responded by taking all their clothes off. And once in the many performances on the tour, I was challenged by a spectator and took my clothes off one time. otherwise, we didn't do that. What it was about the prohibition, and therefore it wasn't really about our being able to break the prohibition, but it was about our hope that these foolish prohibitions, inhibitions of human nature could be overcome in a more trusting world. And I think that those spectators that then took their clothes off, I think were making a daring and good gesture.
Were there ever people in the audience who couldn't handle the kind of confrontation that you were engaging them in? And I'm thinking, too, this is a period when probably a lot of people showed up in the theater high on acid or other drugs and I could just see the possibility for people to flip out in the audience.
Well, those who couldn't handle it and were in their right minds could certainly leave and go somewhere else. And many did. Those who didn't want to deal with that kind of confrontation could go away from it. If somebody is on an acid trip, I would... the thing to do for a person on an acid trip is to help them, and we were all there to help anyone that was unhappy, hysterical, crying, or miserable, or in even out of enthusiasm, endangering themselves or others. Sometimes that happened, because in 68, 69, a lot of people were doing that. And I very often dealt with those people. That was part of my area of obligation. And when that happened, I took them in the dressing room and did what I call the dressing room paradise with them and tried to take them to paradise just as we were. That is, we continued our obligation to take each spectator to paradise. And then when we came out of the street and confronted the police, that was still our obligation. That is, to create a kind of glowing hopefulness, which is as close as I guess we can be to paradise in a world in which there continues to be much misery. But at least the sense that we're working to get rid of the misery can give us a kind of hopefulness.
My guest is Judith Malina, a co-founder of The Living Theater. She is directing a new play now in New York called Us. Now, I know you also wanted to blur the distinctions between art and the rest of life. And one of the things that happened in the early 60s when you were performing a piece called The Brig is that you were arrested, and you were arrested in the theater. The Brig was about conformity, and wasn't there almost a prison-like set?
It was a prison.
Stage? It was a prison.
It was a stage set, but it was a prison. A brig means a military prison, actually a naval prison. And it was a play about the United States Marine Corps and its particular prison system. And it simulated very closely the actual conditions of a prison. And this was unbearably difficult for people to believe what goes on and how it is. And there was much feeling about it, much strong feeling about it, about human beings being treated that way. And the question of, was it true? Were United States Marines in the internal prisons of the Marine Corps treated in that way or not? And it seems that it was very accurate. It was written by someone who was in such a Marine Corps prison. Two of the actors were Marines who knew the ropes of that story. And
but you were arrested for back taxes.
Yes.
And the police came and you, I think, barricaded yourself into the prison.
Yes,
and
imagine
set.
We didn't even owe any taxes. How could that have happened?
Well, what was it like for you to actually lock yourself in on the prison set where you were performing?
What was it like? It was like locking the door on a prison set where one was performing and saying that this was our work and this was our theater, and if anybody wanted to remove us from it, they'd have to take us away from it forcibly, which they did.
And then you ended up in a real prison.
In a real prison, and they closed the door in the real prison. But since we didn't owe any taxes, and it's since been proven that we didn't owe any taxes, and Julian Beck and I did do 60 days in jail for it. He did 60, I did 30, so maybe 90 altogether. But since we did serve time for something of which we were not culpable, and have since proven ourselves not to have owed those taxes, clearly there must have been some other reason for them to have closed that theater, since we didn't owe the taxes. And the reason was, certainly in my opinion, let's say in my opinion the reason is, that someone protested against the showing what really happens in the United States Marine Corps brig, and that the method of getting people for taxes, whether they owe them or not, that's an old ploy the United States uses against all kinds of people.
Well, you've been arrested in around 12 different countries on, mm-hmm. on lots of charges, nudity, I guess... provocation in some places too,
trespassing, mm-hmm. All kinds of things.
And you've been in prisons in I think around 12 different
that's right.
countries. While you have been a prisoner, have your theater techniques in any way helped you survive? Since you were used to a theater of provocation, you were used to really digging down into your own emotions, being very, very expressive. Did you try any of this out to get you by in prison? Did you interact with any of the prisoners in ways that you learned to interact in your confrontational
Surely.
Theater style?
Surely. We always did theater in prisons. When we were in jail, it was part of our obligation not to get through, but to help create the atmosphere for the beautiful nonviolent revolution in or out of jail. It doesn't matter. The same work has to be done. The same human contacts are made.
What would you do in jail?
Prisoners, with guards. Let me give you an example. When the whole company was arrested in Brazil, the men were sent to a penitentiary where they were able to rehearse with the prisoners a prison play invented by the prisoners, a collective creation about the situation of being in the prison.
Were you ever disappointed in the power of theater? Did you ever feel like you wanted theater to change your life and to change the lives of the people who came to see it? Did you ever at some point go through a period of your life thinking, well, maybe theater doesn't have all the power that I want it to have?
If it had all the power that I wanted to have, there'd be no prisons, there'd be no weapons, there'd be no exploitation. I'm constantly disappointed that we don't create more revolutionary situation. And I'm constantly striving to... accelerate the process.
You and Julian Beck left America for many years and lived in different parts of Europe and toured a lot. Then you came back in when, the early 80s, was it?
Yeah, we came back 84.
It's interesting to me that although in your early career you never did much in terms of regular theater, in the 80s you both ended up taking on film roles. Julian Beck was in The Cotton Club and had a role in Miami Vice. You had a role in Miami Vice. You were featured in the movie Radio Days. And you were in Dog Day Afternoon also, weren't
yeah.
you? Did you do that for money or for the pleasure of acting in a movie?
Well, I like very much acting in the movies. I get a lot of pleasure out of it, out of doing it. I would prefer not to do it because it takes time and energy away from what I really want to do. And it's part of the tragedy of the artist and the American American economic structure. Artists have to do work they don't want to do in order to support themselves.
You know,
if I stay in Europe, yeah. I wouldn't have to do that kind of thing. But in the United States, unfortunately, there's no way to support art.
I remember Julian Beck's performance in The Cotton Club. I thought it was such a kind of robust performance. It was so much fun to watch.
Oh, yes.
And the character was so totally unlike who he is, since he's a pacifist vegetarian mm-hmm. playing this cold-hearted, tough-talking gangster.
Mm-hmm.
Did he take a certain pleasure in that? It would have really been a lot of fun to do that role.
Certainly it was a lot of fun. And all the movie work I've done and all the TV work I've done has always been fun in the doing. As I say, what the problem with it is that I should be doing something else. I should be creating a spot for the Living Theater in New York. I have I'm working with a company that needs to work now, that desperately needs to work and that hasn't got a place of its own, and I should be doing that work instead of trying to earn a living. But I have to earn a living.
But when you take on a movie script, is it fun to practice?
It's always fun.
Yeah, and to practice like the craft of acting, learning the lines, getting into the character, the kinds of more traditional things that you
seldom
always, do.
It's more like athletics, I think, than like theater. You know, you try to achieve a certain goal. You try to achieve something. You try to hit something on the mark being exactly what the director wants. And I find it a lot like athletics. You know, like trying to do something correctly once, as opposed to developing over a year a role or a play and beginning to, and able to deepen it.
My guest is Judith Malina, and we're talking about her work with the Living Theater, which she co-founded with Julian Beck in the late 1940s. We're going to talk more about her life and her work after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Judith Malina is my guest. Your husband, Julian Beck, died recently. He had been not only your husband, but your longtime collaborator in the Living Theater.
Yes.
Was it difficult to decide what to do with the Living Theater after he passed away? What direction to take it in, or even whether to disband it or not? What were some of the decisions you had to make about the company?
There was much that was difficult, but it was not difficult to decide to carry on the work because that's what he inspired us to do. He inspired us all to create a theater which would work toward a goal which is far from realized. And as long as there's going to be hunger and as long as there's going to be violence, I think we have some work to do and some work that he left unfinished. And I don't think any of us ever questioned that we should go on with it.
Is the Living Theater taking on any new directions now?
Yes, in a certain sense. In a certain sense, one likes to say that the new direction is always deepening. But we're doing a play now. We're doing a play called Us by Karen Malpede at the Theater for the New City. And the play is a play about sex, about sexuality, about the trap that Freud described when he said that whenever two people make love, there are always six people in bed. That is, the parents of the woman and the parents of the man, or the parents of the two people, whether they be men or women, and that these six people are really present all the time. And this play is about getting those other four people out of that scene and leaving the lovers alone.
You're looking for a new home for the Living Theater now.
We are indeed. We have a wonderful company here. We have a company of 15 people in New York, 15 people in Europe. We got together and did one play, the Retrospectacle, for one night at the Cooper Union, and we won an Obie for it. And this wonderful company needs a home. And there's a marvelous little synagogue that's long abandoned and fallen into decay on 7th Street between Avenue B and Avenue C, down here where the very poor live and where the artists live. And we're making a big campaign now to find the funding and to find the support to set up the Living Theater in that space.
Have you gone to see much theater in the years that you've returned to the United States? I'm thinking when the Living Theater first started, there really wasn't an off-Broadway, so to speak. And now there's a really thriving theater scene that's pretty outside of the mainstream. There's a lot of experimental theater that's been inspired from the theater that you've created in your company. Do you go to check that out?
I see as much as I can, but like all theater people, when you work, you can't go to see theater. But I see a lot of energetic things. I see a lot of wonderful, wonderful artists. And I see a theater that, while it's extremely daring, seems to have very little impact. That is, we can do wonderful things, and it doesn't matter, because we haven't been able to budge the culture. And until we find out what'll really budge the culture, what'll really make people move, not only what'll enthuse them to say, this is a very good play, this is very interesting, or I didn't like that, or I did like that, but to really have a theater that can create some impetus for action, that we seem not to have. And I think it frustrates all the artists that are working in the theater today.
You know, I've recently been reading your diaries, which were published. The diaries, I think, is from 47 to 57. And you wrote in them that when you were young, your mother used to sometimes perform dramatic readings of poetry, and that you'd sometimes find it very upsetting to see her taken over by this emotion, and you wanted your nice, calm mother back. And I was wondering, I know you have two children, if you think that they ever went through that, knowing what you were doing on stage. Now, I don't know if they came to your performances a lot, but certainly, certainly the kinds of things that you were doing on stage were much more emotionally dramatic than your mother reading a poem. Were they shocked by things that they saw you doing?
I think they entered into the theater life very early and knew what it was really from the first in a way that I really didn't understand. They were living not only with theatrical parents, they were living within a theatrical company. And everybody they knew acted. And they acted very young. And they came into it very young. And I think adapted to it very young. Yet I think there is for every theater child a certain moment of shock in seeing. For instance, it's very hard to explain to the young children in the company. One time we were traveling with nine young children, to explain to them why they shouldn't play with guns, but we used guns on the stage. That's a very difficult moral difficulty for the child. If we're playing with guns and they understand it's not real guns, why they can't play with guns or why they shouldn't play with guns or what's the matter with playing with guns since we, in enacting scenes, use them. This is an interesting kind of more moral question. It's a little more sophisticated than just being afraid of your good mother suddenly turning into a... That is, my daughter Isha, I was pregnant with Isha when I was playing Antigone. And then when she was 7 weeks after she was born, she sat in a basket at the side of the stage or backstage during the performances when she was just really a tiny infant. And I don't think that... And later she played in Antigone and became one of the actors in that play. So that there was never a time when she didn't know, when there wasn't an Antigone. That play, she was born into it, and she played it later, and it's always been part of her life. Even though it has some horrendous scenes, those are scenes that she knows from earliest childhood, and that are part of her vision of the world, that people do this, and that it isn't in fact hurtful. And that it is, in fact, creates a lot of good energy and enthusiasm.
You came out of a home that was pretty religious. Your father was a rabbi. Did your parents have any objections to you not only going into theater, but also living a very radical, very bohemian life?
I think maybe the radical bohemian part troubled my mother later. But I was intended to become an actress. My mother was an actress. And my mother met a young rabbi who was still a rabbinical student at the time and had to give up the theater. Though she had, she was already an admirer of the young director, Erwin Piscator. But she gave it up. And she gave it up with the agreement that they too would have a child, a daughter, who would become the actress instead of my mother. That is, I'm a surrogate for my mother, so that I was trained to be in the theater from the very beginning. I was meant to be in the theater. And I always considered it like part of my destiny. My father died when I was 13, so he didn't see me get very radical. Though I already had problems about hating Nazis. I already had pacifist problems with him about that. But later, surely, the bohemian way of life did trouble my mother.
Can I ask how you met Julian Beck?
How did I meet Julian Beck? I met Julian Beck because I was hanging out when I was 17 years old in front of an actors' club called Genius Incorporated here on 46th Street. And I was waiting to have some interesting contact with real actors. And I didn't know many real actors, and I was very in awe of real actors. And I was eating chocolates in front of the Genius Incorporated, the St. James Hotel. It's still standing there. The St. James Hotel is that is still standing there. And a young man came by and said, "I'm hungry. I haven't eaten for 2 days. Could you give me a piece of chocolate?" And I gave him all the chocolates in my pocket. And he was a very talkative young man, and I took him into the, and he told me how he was a young actor who hadn't made any progress, and he had nothing to eat. So I took him into the automat next door, and I bought him a sandwich, and he said, "I'm going to do you a favor because of what you have done for me. I'm going to call up a young man who is the most witty, the most brilliant, the most magnificent, the most poetic, the most fantastic person you've ever met." And he went and he called Julian Beck and said, "I have met a woman who is the most marvelous, the most witty, the richest." I was on home relief at the time. I was on welfare. "The richest, the most beautiful." I was far from that. "The most marvelous woman you ever met. You must come down here and meet her." And he brought me together with Julian Beck, and the moment we looked at each other, we knew that we had much work to do together and much life to live together.
It sounds like there was a certain amount of theater behind your meeting.
Yes, there seemed to be. My life has been, I've been blessed with a lot of theatrical events. This is good for writing a publishable diary.
You bet. Well, Judith Malina, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts with us. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
My guest has been Judith Malina. She and her late husband, Julian Beck, co-founded the Living Theater. It became one of the most revolutionary theater groups in the world. She's now directing Us at the Theater for the New City in Manhattan. It's a play by Karen Malpied. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.